Today on The World, Christine Lagarde breaks down barriers, the first woman to be finance minister in France, the first woman to head the International Monetary Fund, and now she's likely to be the first woman to head the European Central Bank. All her past experiences have shaped who Christine Lagarde is today.
She used to joke when she was finance minister that synchronized swimming taught her the habit of gritting her teeth and smiling, which was probably very useful, certainly in French political circles.
Also, an Australian student went missing in North Korea and reappears in China. And a pro tennis player is fined at Wimbledon for not even trying.
There's no effort. It's nothing. Mind-boggling. That was just abysmal.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Glad you could make it here on this 4th of July. There's this video from last week in which Ivanka Trump tried to join a policy conversation between Theresa May and IMF chief Christine Lagarde. In the short clip, Lagarde does not seem impressed. Known as a rock star of international finance, she has a reputation for telling it like it is. Lagarde is about to leave her post as the head of the International Monetary Fund and take over the top job at the European Central Bank from current President Mario Draghi. Christine Lagarde will be the first woman to hold this position, which oversees the euro and eurozone monetary policy. Ben Hall is Europe editor of the Financial Times, and he says the appointment was unexpected for a couple of reasons.
She's not an economist. Perhaps more importantly, she has no expertise in monetary policy. And although you might be able to get away with it as chief of the International Monetary Fund, when you are a central banker, you have to take real-time decisions and engage in real-time debates with other central bankers. So you really do need to have some technical expertise.
Yeah, previous presidents of the European Central Bank were heads of smaller central banks, which is something that Lagarde does not have on her resume. Will that fact work against her?
Well, it might work against her with them in particular, who may think that she is not up to their level, and therefore the dynamics within the European Central Bank may be different than up to now, where Mario Draghi is an incredibly well-respected central banker and has really commanded authority within the central bank, although he, of course, is not beyond criticism. So the question really is whether she can hold her own amongst other central bankers, because, of course, there is some criticism within the European Central Bank of the route that it has taken.
What's the range of reaction you've heard on her nomination?
Well, I think it's actually been broadly very supportive. The markets have absolutely loved it. There are a lot of heavyweight economists out there who think she'll be very good at the job because of she's such a great political operator and knows how to surround herself with real experts. But there are still other people who would say that they worry about her lack of technical expertise. And they also worry about this broader trend of former politicians or non-economists becoming central bankers and worry that that might dilute the idea of central bank independence. It's the same with the US Fed, right, where you have Jay Powell, who's a lawyer. But even Jay Powell has had a number of years on the Federal Reserve Board of Governors. So that is something that Christine Lagarde does not have.
Before we continue on what Lagarde will mean as head of the European Central Bank, let's dig a bit into her background. A lawyer by training and then goes headfirst into the economic realm, starting with the post of French Commerce Minister in the government of Dominique de Villepin in 2005. There's also this small interesting detail. She was a synchronized swimmer for the French national team. She's also a vegetarian and rarely drinks alcohol. All of that suggests some serious self-discipline. What does that tell us about her?
I think it does tell you that she has serious self-discipline. She used to joke when she was finance minister that synchronized swimming taught her the habit of gritting her teeth and smiling, which was probably very useful, certainly in French political circles, because she's really not a kind of typical French politician at all. She doesn't think like French politicians. And in fact, her image in France is not as great as it is elsewhere in the world, particularly the Anglo-Saxon world. She is very self-disciplined. She is an extremely good and charismatic communicator. She's a great manager of people and a bridge builder. And I think those will be great skills for her.
Ben, you must have seen the video from the G20 that went viral recently in which Ivanka Trump steps into this policy conversation between Theresa May and Christine Lagarde and offers her opinions. Lagarde was most visibly annoyed by this interruption, by this somewhat unqualified voice. What did you see in that video that tells us anything else about Christine Lagarde?
In some ways, I thought that was actually rather uncharacteristic of her, because she's not sort of hoity-toity. She's quite a good people person. She is not very grand. But then she's also been a sort of staunch defender of the international order, the kind of rules-based order. And I suppose, in a way, Ivanka Trump's presence at the G20 was sort of emblematic of the Trump administration's, some people might say, contempt for that model of governance.
Lagarde has been called the rock star of international finance. How did she get that label?
Well, she was an untypical French politician. She was an untypical finance minister, given her style, her charisma, her brilliance with the English language, the fact that she's not a kind of grandstander. And I think once that was translated on totally onto the sort of international stages as managing director of the IMF, she just played to her strengths and has had a pretty faultless performance at the IMF. And the IMF has done rather well under her tenure. She, you know, it was in a bit of a bad state when she took over. It was completely divided over the bailouts of Greece. It made mistakes there. It made mistakes over austerity. And I think she's kind of restored confidence and intellectual credibility in a way to the IMF. And I think that's it's a thoroughly good thing for the fund.
Yeah, certainly good bona fides for going into the European Central Bank. She's also been very vocal on women's rights and has championed promoting women into powerful positions. The European Central Bank, though, is a very male-heavy organization. Will she be able to change or even operate, as she has in the past, in that culture?
I think she will have no problem operating in that culture. Whether she can actually fundamentally change the gender balance and the culture of the European Central Bank may be a taller order.
Christine Lagarde's first day on the job, in theory, at the ECB is November 1st. That's the day after the new deadline set for Britain to leave the European Union. What kind of challenge does that suggest for her on day one?
Well, until now, the European Central Bank has tended to think that Brexit will not be such a big economic shock to the Eurozone. But a no-deal Brexit, where there's a sort of sudden break and there is no transition period and there's big disruption to trade flows, could cause real pain to some Eurozone countries like Ireland, maybe the Netherlands, even to Germany and bits of France. So they will be watching that very, very closely. Whether they will need to do much to actually compensate for that is another question.
Ben Hall is Europe editor for the Financial Times. He's been speaking with us from London. Ben, thanks very much.
You're very welcome.
Temperatures are still soaring in France, an unlucky break for teenagers there who are doing national service for the first time. France had similar programs in the past, but they ended 2 decades ago. This new national service program was introduced by President Emmanuel Macron. 2 weeks of training, followed by another 2 weeks of community work. It's voluntary for now, but eventually it'll be required for all 16-year-olds. Macron hopes it'll boost patriotism and social cohesion. It's not without controversy, though. The BBC's Paris correspondent Lucy Williamson reports.
It's not the liveliest rendition of the French national anthem, and there are rumours not all the teenagers standing here know all the words. But then it is only 8 o'clock in the morning, and they're in unfamiliar territory, lined up on a makeshift parade ground in military-style uniform for the daily raising of the flag. These are the first recruits for President Macron's new national service. 2 weeks of residential training, followed by 2 weeks of community work. More scout camp than old-style military service, disappointing for at least one young recruit.
My dad did military service. He used to tell me about it. I'd like to do military service like him. It's longer, it's harsher, there's more physical activity, but unfortunately it's not possible.
Mr. Macron had originally wanted a more military-style programme, but the army reportedly balked at training up the nation's teenagers. Instead, the civil programme includes a day of map reading, strategy and orienteering, run by members of the armed forces. The president says he wants the new programme to boost patriotism and social cohesion among young people. It's due to become compulsory for all 16-year-olds by 2026. But why does France need it? Gabriel Attal is the junior education minister responsible for launching the scheme.
What is missing is a moment of cohesion of youth coming from different places in France, coming from different social backgrounds, sharing their experiences, sharing their commitments for the country and for the society.
Well, that's one explanation. Here's another.
Mes chers amis, quelle journée!
Mr. Macron has framed French politics as a battle between himself and the far-right leader Marine Le Pen, who came first in the European elections last month with her brand of inward-looking nationalism. Bruno Cortrez is a prominent political scientist here.
Emmanuel Macron do not want to leave the field of patriotism to Marine Le Pen. I think that what Macron is trying to show to the French public is that there is no contradiction for him to be pro-European and patriotic, pro-European and to believe in your country, pro-European Union and also to be proud to be French.
So perhaps it's not just patriotism President Macron wants to boost, but the right kind of patriotism. And if so, is compulsory national service the way to do it?
I think it's a very, very sensitive issue, and the way that you do it is going to make it as a success or as a complete failure. Because France is a promise of liberté, égalité, fraternité. But when you look to the young French with low level of education or the young French having non-French origins, you could see that the promise of social and political integration is not really there. So learning the theory is not going to work, because it could create quite a terrible gap between the promise and the realities.
Surveys have suggested that a new national service is popular with French voters, but not so much with the teenagers who'd have to do it.
Being patriotic is not the issue. The issue is that we are making like kids like robots, you know.
Matteo Comar is a 16-year-old spokesperson for a national student union. Mr. Macron's new programme, he says, is not only indoctrination, it's hypocritical too.
The government of today is not promoting at all the acting for community. The principle of the system is to be like selfish a bit, you know, working for yourself and for your money and things like that. So now for them to come and say, so it's community, we need to share things, etc. Yes, we agree, but that's not what they are doing at all.
As many in France feel the sense of national identity fragmenting under the pressures from a changing world, Mr. Macron, it seems, is keen to get everyone singing the same tune.
The BBC's Lucy Williamson reporting there from Paris. Also in France this week, the championship teams are set for the Women's World Cup finals this Sunday. But in Argentina, soccer is taking a different face. More on that later this hour. Here's a story we're working on for tomorrow's edition of The World. As Jared Kushner promotes his vision of a Middle East peace, some Palestinians in the U.S. want to tell their version of history. They've opened up the Museum of the Palestinian People. It's just blocks away from the White House.
We welcome people with open hearts, right, to come and have a conversation with us. And it doesn't matter if they agree or not. The most important is the conversation.
The conversation could take museum visitors into the heart of Middle East tensions.
We want them to learn that there is a country that was called Palestine. It existed. There is people who were displaced because someone came and took the land.
History from a Palestinian perspective on display in America's capital. We tour the Museum of the Palestinian People. That's tomorrow. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. International pressure against Iran is widely felt inside the country today because of U.S. sanctions. 10 years ago this summer, Iran was also in turmoil, but the cause was purely domestic politics. In June 2009, millions took to the streets of Tehran over the outcome of a presidential election. Officially, hardliner Mahmoud Ahmadinejad won in a landslide. Reformers claimed their candidate had actually won. When Iranian security forces cracked down on the protests, there was bloodshed, and one woman's death symbolized the moment, as the BBC's Farhana Haider reports.
A young woman, Neda Aga Sultan, was shot dead at a demonstration in Tehran, her death filmed on a mobile phone. She became an icon for Iran's reform movement. I spoke to Arash Hijazi, who tried to save Neda's life as she bled on the street.
She is still cherished. She was a symbol. She is a person who gave her life and raised the awareness about the situation in Iran. So people love her, they cherish her, they admire her, and they haven't forgotten her.
Arash Hijazi had trained as a doctor, but by 2009, he'd given up his medical career to concentrate on writing and publishing. At the elections of June 12, 2009, he'd voted for the reform candidate, Mir Hussein Mousavi. And when hardliner Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was declared the winner, he joined the increasing number of peaceful protesters taking to the streets of Iran's big cities. Then, on June 19th, Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, came forward.
Everybody anticipated that he would step in and try to settle the situation. But on the Friday, the supreme leader came and basically threatened the whole nation and said, if you don't go home, the responsibility of what happens is on those people, those candidates who were encouraging people to protest.
I want everyone to stop what they have been doing. If they don't, they are responsible for the chaos they have created.
It was evident that people were not going home. And I was quite concerned because we knew after those threats by the supreme leader, we would see violence.
The following day, at his publishing company, Arash Hijazi waited anxiously to see what would happen next.
In the afternoon, we started hearing news that people were gathering in the streets. My younger, more impatient colleagues were anxious to go out and join. And I tried to stop them, but I couldn't. So when they decided to go out, I said, okay, I'll join you. I wanted to be the grown-up person in the team and make sure they didn't do anything silly or somehow if I could protect them. So we went out. We didn't have to go far from our office and the protests were happening already there.
So on that day, you could feel the tension?
Yes, it was tense. There were lots of plainclothes militia walking around the people. There was the smell of tear gas in the air.
And how did you come across Neda?
Me and my colleagues were standing on the pavement watching the protests. Neda and a more senior person were standing next to us. That gentleman, we later found out, was her music teacher. She was standing there. She was chanting with the rest of the protesters. She wasn't part of the protest, but she wanted to join the protest. Her music teacher was insisting that she would stay away from it. Then they released tear gas among the public, and everybody started running in different directions. Me and my colleagues and also Neda and her music teacher, we started running in the same direction. And at that point, we heard a blast. Seconds later, we saw Neda just coughing and blood gushing out of her chest, and she fell to the ground. Obviously, we realized that she was shot, and that was the blast. So we ran to her. I thought, because of my medical background, I could help her. She was shot in the chest and she was in a state of shock. I tried to stop the bleeding and another person was trying to open up her airways, and we were hoping that we could get her into a car and get her to a hospital, but everything happened so fast, and my assessment was that the bullet had hit her aorta, so she bled out in less than a minute, really. When I realized that she was gone, I stood aside. The other people carried her into a car to take her to a hospital. But obviously, by the time she had arrived to the hospital, there was nothing they could have done.
Traumatized, Arash went back to his office with his colleagues. They also took along the man who'd filmed Neda's death on his mobile phone.
We were all in a state of shock. What we did after that was to take the video off his phone, and everybody posted it to whoever they knew outside Iran. Everybody was seriously angry at that injustice. It was really unjust what had happened to that woman, an unarmed woman standing on a side being targeted like that. Then later, when it was dark, I went to see my parents. Obviously, I didn't want my mother to see me in all those bloody clothes. So when my dad opened the door, I gave him a very quick brief. I took my shirt off, changed my shirt, and I went into the room. And we put on the news. And at that point, as soon as I arrived at home, we put on the CNN, and I saw myself and Neda on the CNN. It had gone already there.
Did you expect that footage to have the impact that it did?
No, not at all. All we did was to send it to a few people we knew outside Iran. Cruelty cannot be gone unnoticed. From the time we sent the video out, and by the time I got home, it was 3 hours. And it was already on every news channel in the world. And also the repercussions after that, it wasn't just a piece of news. Days after, we heard Obama talking about it.
And we've experienced the searing image of a woman bleeding to death on the streets. While this loss is raw and extraordinarily painful, we also know this: those who stand up for justice are always on the right side of history.
I was terrified because I knew my face was quite clear on that camera. And in Iran, as an author, I thought I could be recognized. Therefore, I was terrified.
Arash lay low for a few days, but soon realized he would have to leave Tehran.
As soon as I arrived in the UK, my mobile phone started ringing and the media were all over me. And I didn't talk to the press at that point. And when I saw that the Iranian government had been denying the whole incident, claiming that it was fake and staged, I got quite angry. And at that point, I felt the least I can do is to talk about it as a witness.
The so-called Green Movement protests continued in Iran despite the authorities' brutal suppression.
Iranian police used tear gas and batons to disperse thousands of people who'd gathered to commemorate the death of a young woman who was caught up in the recent political protests.
Just look at the defiance. The policeman is beating him, but this demonstrator refuses to give in. So the police open fire.
The mass demonstrations and civil disobedience continued until February 2010, when the authorities arrested several Green Movement leaders and cracked down on a rally in support of the emerging Arab revolutions. So would Arash say those protests and Neda's death led to much change in Iran?
At the face value, if you look at it, people may think nothing changed. I don't believe so. I strongly believe that it made a huge difference. It created an awareness to the world that not to take what the governments of these countries think at face value, and actually they are not representative of the real aspirations and thoughts of the Iranians.
Arash Hejazi speaking there to the BBC's Farhana Haider, recalling the unrest in Iran 10 years ago and the death of protester Neda Aga Sultan. You're listening to The World.
Hi, I want to tell you about a new PRX podcast called Things That Go Boom. It's all about foreign policy, but not in the way you might think. At Things That Go Boom, they tell stories about our lives and the world around us in an effort to better understand the ins, outs, and what have yous of what keeps us safe. On the new season, they tell the story of the secret back-channel meetings, political ploys, and even broken bones that led to the Iran nuclear deal. And since President Trump yanked us out of that deal, they ask, are we headed for nuclear war? Things That Go Boom's second season, called Fallout, is available now. Listen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents in Argentina are pushing back against the country's sex ed curriculum. It teaches children about puberty, pregnancy, sexually transmitted diseases, and LGBT issues.
Critics have been circulating the hashtag Con mis hijos no te metas. Don't mess with my kids.
I'm Marco Werman. That story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. After 4 years of stalemate, the war in Yemen seems to be heading in a new direction. The United Arab Emirates this week announced it was pulling out. Token forces will remain, but most of their troops are going home. The UAE has been Saudi Arabia's main ally, helping them fight against Yemen's Houthi rebels, who have links to Iran. And the United States has been supporting Saudi Arabia and the UAE in their fight, despite credible allegations of war crimes and human rights abuses. So what does it mean for the war in Yemen that the UAE is pulling its troops out? Bill Law is a journalist who covers the Gulf. He's in London. First of all, Bill, why is the UAE pulling out? Is this in response to international protests about those alleged war crimes and human rights abuses?
No, Marco, not at all. The UAE is pulling out primarily because they pretty much achieved the objective they set themselves when they first went into this war back in March of 2015.
Mohammed bin Zayed, who's the crown prince of Abu Dhabi, he and Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, decided that they needed to take action against the Houthis because the Houthis were driving towards Aden, which is a key port in the south of the country. And they realized then they had to step in. It was the Emiratis who put ground troops in, and they're the ones that pretty much have secured the south. And their reasons for going in were pretty clear. They wanted to get Aden. They wanted to really secure the south. They've pretty much done that. They've worked with secessionist forces. So they've been really able to accomplish pretty much what they wanted to achieve. So it makes sense for them now to pull back.
How are the Saudis reacting? Because this UAE withdrawal from Yemen would seem to leave the Saudis hanging now.
They haven't responded in any way yet to what the Emiratis have done, and I don't expect they will publicly. I think behind the scenes there will be conversations, and it may be that Mohammed bin Salman is a little taken aback because, as I said, Mohammed bin Zayed, who is 24 years Mohammed bin Salman senior, Mohammed bin Salman, 33 years old, young, reckless, somewhat feckless leader, Mohammed bin Zayed, 57 years old, very clever, very shrewd. So I think we'll have to wait and see what the Saudi response will be. I would hope that Mohammed bin Salman would take the opportunity to make a dramatic positive step and declare a unilateral ceasefire of the aerial campaign.
When I think of the UAE, I got to say, I think of luxury high-rises in the malls of Dubai and Abu Dhabi. I don't see the UAE as this kind of battle-hardy warrior nation. So how good is their military?
Well, that's a very good question. I'll tell you, Jim Mattis, who was the Secretary of Defense, he had a great deal of respect for the Emiratis. He called them Little Sparta. Now, the Emiratis, they worked with the Americans in Afghanistan. They were assisting in the fight against Daesh. And so the Americans have a great deal of respect for this small country. And remember, it's very well armed. The Emiratis are one of the biggest purchasers. The Saudis are the biggest of high-tech military weaponry. Unlike the Saudis, the Emiratis know how to use it and use it effectively. In fact, this country, which, as you say, projects this image of high rises and tourism and business friendly and a tolerant, peaceful place, is also a quite aggressive militarily and has become increasingly aggressive. And I think that image of a quiet, peaceful, friendly place has undergone a transformation. And it's one, to be frank, the Americans support and applaud.
One last thing, Bill, and this may seem off the Yemen story. Washington, as you know, has been driving the confrontation with Iran. But how is that impacting the wider region? Is there confidence in Gulf capitals that the U.S. knows what it's doing?
Well, I think that there is a general anxiety about Donald Trump because of the intemperate way with which he swings. At the same time, the Gulf rulers are hugely happy that Donald Trump is in the White House. They say anybody would be better than Obama. They really took an intense dislike to President Obama. I think the view in these capitals, in Riyadh, in Abu Dhabi, in Kuwait City, is that this war is not going to happen. That although the pressures are there, I think that there's a sense that things are starting to cool down a little bit. Once again, everyone can see that it's in no one's interest to have a war, particularly in regards to the Gulf nations who sit right next door to Iran.
Veteran Mideast journalist Bill Law speaking with us from London. Thank you very much.
Pleasure. Thank you.
The Women's World Cup finals are this weekend. Team USA versus the Netherlands. My mom is Dutch, so I still don't know who to cheer for. But here's some soccer news that's not related to cleats or goalies. In Argentina, a pro soccer team, River Plate, is getting praise for opening its stadium to help homeless people. It's winter now in Buenos Aires, and temperatures have dropped as low as 36 degrees Fahrenheit. That's the coldest temperature recorded this year in Argentina. Here's Gisela Jerez, one of the volunteers helping out at that soccer stadium. She says there are so many people living on the streets and few people to help them. Macarena Gagliardi is a journalist in Buenos Aires. What got River Plate, the Argentine soccer team, to open its stadium doors to the homeless? Has that ever happened before?
No, not that I can remember, actually. And I think it's something very important because obviously football in Argentina is one of the biggest passions of the society. So it's a very good way to show and to give visibility to the people going through this situation, you know, and making aware the society.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, apparently a lot of people are aware of the situation. Perhaps that's because of a recent incident of a 52-year-old homeless man dying in the streets.
Yes, and luckily it has been covered. That sad death made it into the news. He's not the only one, or it's not an isolated case. You have people dying of cold and hunger in different parts of the country. When you live in a place, in a country, in a city where it's so frequent seeing people on the street, there is a moment when you stop seeing them somehow.
Yeah, it's a crisis I see that is getting worse in Buenos Aires. It's the capital. It's one of the richest cities. And yet the homeless population has doubled in the past 3 years.
Yes.
Almost 200,000 people living on the streets.
Yes.
What's going on?
In Argentina, we have a high rate of poverty. That means financial crisis make middle class and working class to go down instead of up. You don't have an ascension, you know, or an aspirational possibility in society. It's the opposite. You try to keep yourself floating so as not to go deeper.
Are there no shelters in Buenos Aires? Because when temperatures go down in Boston in the winter here, homeless are often taken to shelters, so there are no fatalities. That doesn't happen there?
No. You have some shelters. You have two things. The state of them, the not enough amount of them, the not enough facilities. And then what you have is like when people tend to live on the streets for many, many, many years, for them it's very hard to adjust to the rules of a shelter. And I can tell you this because some years ago, I lived next to a train station and there was an old man living there. So I used to feed him and chat. And he was explaining to me, you know, that when you live on the street, you live in a way that it has nothing to do with what we socially is expected regarding, you know, appearance and hygiene, etc.
What has Argentina's president, Mauricio Macri, said about the homeless problem?
Particularly not anything. Depending to who you talked, actually, because we are in a presidential election year, they need to address somehow the social matters. But the government yesterday, you know, in Europe, celebrating a new free trade agreement and talking about expecting soon a free trade agreement with the United States. So obviously he's very much aware of something else.
Will that be an issue in the upcoming election?
I think so. First, because it's a reality and people are concerned. Secondly, it's something that you can very easily use during a campaign in countries like Argentina, you know, and in South America, where being with the poor, being with people can look as you care, that you're going to pay attention to them. Hopefully, it's going to be a long-term policy. I think that Argentina needs to start facing this situation, because in a society where you have 33% of poverty, the future of that society looks kind of in a risk, no?
Journalist Macarena Gagliardi speaking with us from Buenos Aires, Argentina, about the homeless problem there. Thank you very much, Macarena.
Thanks to you, Marco, and the whole team.
Another thing that has Argentina talking right now is sex education. The country has had a law for years that requires schools to teach a comprehensive sex ed curriculum, but in some ways the predominantly Catholic country still has not come to terms with it. And when a bill to legalize abortion came before Congress last summer, it revived a debate about what Argentine kids should learn in school about sexuality. The World's Alison Herrera reports from Buenos Aires.
About 50 teenagers and young adults are squeezed into a small classroom in the Casa Fusa Health Clinic in Buenos Aires. They're working in groups on their final presentations. Those presentations, they're about sex. And right now, they're demonstrating how to use a condom. There's some nervous laughter. These young people are wrapping up a free 5-week class in sex education. The class, it shouldn't be necessary because in Argentina, comprehensive sex education has been required in school since 2006.
The curriculum, known as the ESI, or Educación Sexual Integral, is designed to teach children about changes in their bodies and preventing pregnancy and sexually transmitted infections. It also covers understanding of LGBT issues. But advocates say many schools and provinces aren't teaching the curriculum in a consistent way, and some, they aren't teaching it at all. Laura Moses, who's 19, says she signed up for this class at the clinic because the sex ed course she had at school, it just wasn't very good.
We had a class of 1 hour. In this 1 hour, they told us everything of feminine hygiene, and they also separated us in boys and girls.
There was nothing, she says, about sexuality and LGBT issues.
I think it's necessary, first of all, because it's not only about how to have safe sex, it's also how to embrace a more inclusive lifestyle with, you know, it's how to teach to respect another, to not violate rights.
That part about inclusivity has been a big concern for religious and conservative groups. And it's come to a head this past year, as the debate in 2018 over legalizing abortion exposed deep divisions in the country. Since late last year, critics of the ESI have been circulating the hashtag Con mis hijos no te metas, don't mess with my kids. Some have complained that the sex education curriculum encourages kids to have sex, and they say the focus on valuing sexual diversity promotes a gay lifestyle, without taking into account other points of view.
Que ser hombre o mujer no son las únicas opciones.
Que nuestros valores morales sobre la sexualidad y la familia están desfasados.
This video on a Don't Mess With My Kids Facebook page is for a march this week in Buenos Aires. The organizers oppose the, quote, gender ideology they say the curriculum is forcing on their kids. Daniela Amara, who runs the sex education class at Casa Fusa, says that's just not accurate.
They disseminate a lot of false information about the sex education curriculum, and now some schools are afraid to teach it, even though it's the law.
Mara says it's important that schools around the country teach the curriculum, because it's not just about gender and preventing pregnancy. It also talks about consent, and that's a huge issue in Argentina, she says. A 2016 report from Argentina's health ministry found that many pregnancies that occur in teenagers under the age of 15 are the result of sexual violence, and a lot of it occurs within families.
Okay, mi nombre es Enrique Stola. Soy médico psiquiatra hace 40 años.
Enrique Stola is a psychologist who works with adolescents, and he says in his 40 years of practice, he's seen many cases of abuse. He says the ESI curriculum helps kids understand what's okay and what's not, and when they can say no.
Cuando los niños y las niñas tienen esas palabras, saben a quién pedir ayuda.
Whenever kids have those words, they know who to ask for help. But if no one tells them what their body is, what their rights are, how adults should behave with their bodies, then they are totally defenseless against any sexual abuser.
Stola says that the curriculum helps give young people tools to protect themselves. And that's critical in an environment where more and more women have been speaking out about abuse. As for Laura Moses, the 19-year-old taking the class at the clinic, she says she plans to teach what she's learned at her local community center. She says it's about how to have a healthier community for everyone. For The World, Alison Herrera, Buenos Aires.
Meet some of the young Argentines in Alison's story and see the sex ed lessons they're learning. It's all in our Instagram story. We're at PRI The World. Alison's reporting was supported by the International Women's Media Foundation. An Australian graduate student who went missing in North Korea has reappeared in China. Alex Sigley lives in Pyongyang, North Korea, where he was apparently detained 10 days ago. The 29-year-old had little to say to reporters as he arrived in Beijing today.
Are you safe?
Can we get through, please? Can we get through?
Are you all right?
I'm okay. I'm fine.
Australia doesn't have a diplomatic relationship with North Korea, so Australian authorities relied on Sweden to facilitate Sigley's release. The Australian Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, thanked Sweden in a speech before Parliament today.
This outcome demonstrates the value of the discreet, behind-the-scenes work of officials in resolving complex and sensitive consular cases in close partnership with other governments. I'm sure we all could not be more pleased that we not only know where Alex is, but we know he is safe.
As we told you last week, Sigley's family had reported him missing when he stopped his regular communications and social media posts from Pyongyang 10 days ago. His father talked to reporters outside his home in Perth and thanked Australian officials for their work on his son's behalf. He did not share details of what had transpired, but said Alec had kept his spirits up the whole time.
I'm just so happy to know that he's safe and sound. So, yeah, Alec is a special young man, and we're very proud of Alec and all his achievements. And I'm sure this will be a story to be told about this in due course, and I'll just leave it at that.
So there's relief that Sigley is alive and well, but a lot of unanswered questions about why he was detained and how he was treated by authorities in North Korea. You might be asking a much bigger question: what is an Australian guy doing living in North Korea in the first place? Earlier this year, The World's Patrick Nguyen reported for us on Sigley's unusual life in Pyongyang. Here's part of that story.
So my name is Alec Sigley. I'm from Australia.
Alec is 29. He's a student at Kim Il-sung University, the country's most elite school. There are about 50 foreign students there, mostly from China. Alec is one of very few from a country that's cozy with the U.S., and he can sort of pass for a local.
Because I'm half Chinese, I can blend in a little bit more. And there have been times where I've been talking to people, and then halfway through the conversation, they're like, hang on, you're not like Korean, are you?
Alec is getting a master's degree. His thesis is on romance in North Korean literature. And get this, as a student, he can roam North Korea's capital without a minder.
So basically in Pyongyang, you can go anywhere you like. You don't need to have a guide with you. There are a lot of shops and restaurants that tourists can't visit that you can go to.
Alec tweets from inside North Korea all the time, with no censorship. His tweets are a rare window into daily life in Pyongyang, which, for a supposed bastion of anti-capitalism, seems to involve buying a lot of stuff.
The consumer economy has grown quite significantly in the past couple of years, and that's manifested itself in the form of new restaurants with everything from pizza, conveyor belt sushi. There's a conveyor belt hot pot restaurant that's really good.
It's not the North Korea you're used to hearing about. So what about the gulags and the poverty and the horrible oppression? Well, that's all still happening. But Kim Jong-un's changes are also creating a nouveau riche: traders, shopkeepers, people whose power comes from entrepreneurship, not just being an officer in the regime. As for Alec, he's been obsessed with North Korean society for years. That's why he started learning Korean in his early 20s. But he says he's not a cheerleader for the North Korean state.
Simply going to a place and being there doesn't mean that I support everything about the politics there. Me visiting the United States doesn't mean that I support the war in Iraq or anything like that.
Still, he does have good connections. You need those just to get into university. And he built them over the last 5 years, running Tong Il Tours, his own company, which brings English-speaking tourists into Pyongyang. Yes, Alec is also an entrepreneur in North Korea. Not that he's basking in luxury. He lives in a college dorm with North Koreans. His last roommate, by the way, had an interesting hobby.
The extracurricular activity he was doing was working on his goose stepping.
Goose stepping, you know, that really intense marching style with the super high kicks.
He participated in a parade, one of those military parades where he marched in front of Kim Jong-un.
Veneration of the state does seep into everything, which means so does hatred of the U.S. North Korea is still punished by U.S. sanctions, but this society, whose people have been taught to hate the U.S. since birth, it seems some of them have an open mind about the future.
Some of the students saying to me as well, this is a new era. We're entering a new phase, and they're still cautious, but at least they embrace some hope that U.S.-DPRK relations can improve.
The voice there of Australian graduate student Alec Sigley in a report we aired in February by The World's Patrick Nguyen. Sigley disappeared in Pyongyang 10 days ago and today reappeared safe and sound in Beijing. Swedish diplomats helped Australia arrange his release from North Korea. Finally today, a shocker at the Wimbledon tennis tournament in England. Not talking about Venus Williams getting eliminated by 15-year-old Coco Gauff. This is about the outcome of a first-round match on the men's side of the tournament. Australian Bernard Tomic lost in straight sets to Joe Wilfried Tsonga of France. That wasn't the surprising part. What took everyone aback was the apparent lack of effort by Tomic. Even the TV commentators ripped into Tomic's performance all through the match.
That last effort was horrendous.
Oh, my goodness. Well, there have been so many adjectives used to describe Bernard Tomic. It's bordering on an embarrassment.
It's like not a very good practice session at the moment. I mean, it's just awful. There's no effort. There's nothing. Mind-boggling. That was just abysmal.
Well, the less we say about this match, the better. I don't know why he's smiling, because many will find that match distasteful.
That includes the organizers at Wimbledon. Today they announced they're stripping Tomic of his earnings from Tuesday's distasteful match, about $56,000, basically, for not even trying. A statement said the referee felt the player's performance did not meet the required professional standards at Wimbledon. Ouch, double fault. Tomic later claimed he was trying, but when questioned by reporters, he also admitted that he played terribly.
Yeah, I mean, played pretty bad.
Are you happy with the effort levels you put in?
What?
You're happy, though, with the effort you were putting in? It just wasn't
that. Next question, please.
Next question, please, he mumbled. Not much effort in that answer, either. This is not the first time Bernard Tomic's performance on the tennis court comes under scrutiny. 2 years ago, after another lackluster first-round defeat at Wimbledon, he was fined for faking an injury. Back then, he told reporters he was bored with tennis, and yet there he was at Wimbledon this week, still not giving it his all. The key to success, they say, is consistency. I guess the lesson here is just don't be consistently ambivalent. Our theme music was composed by Ned Porter. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Happy 4th, everybody. We'll be back with you tomorrow.